This is the Aftermarket Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Carm Capriotto, Remarkable Results Radio, in another Town Hall Academy. It's really truly going to be a mastermind. Trust me, when you meet my panel. You know how much fun we have doing this stuff? I think we're episode 383. So just put that in your divided by 52 calculator, and you'll realize how long we've been at this. Hey, we want to give a great high five to our wonderful partners. Let's face it, your shop management system is the most critical tool in your shop. And NapaTrax will move your shop into the SMS fast lane with on-site training and 6 days a week support. Also, huge local representation. Find NapaTrax on the web at NapaTrax.com. Hey, auto shop owners, imagine investing in a change that transforms your business and multiplies your net profit. On average, our clients see a staggering 9x return on their investment in net profit. AutoFix, auto shop coaching at AutoShopCoaching.com. And hey, are you ready to optimize training with today's class? In just 5 minutes daily, boost knowledge, all that kind of great retention, and improve team performance. Start seeing results today. Join your peers at todaysclass.com. Hey, I'm honored to have this all-star panel with me. I got goosebumps. Dwayne Myers is with us, Dynamic Automotive. 6, 7 stores. Dwayne, where are we now? I lose track.
Only at 6 at the moment. I'm trying to catch up to Rick, but it's hard.
Rick Levitan, AutoStream, Car Care, 10 locations. Hey, Rick.
How you doing, Carm?
He's our real estate mogul, by the way. Got to go to the website, type in Rick Levitan, and listen to the episode on real estate. Good stuff. And also with us is Hunt Demarest, CPA, an accredited business valuator from Parmelis and the Aftermarket Radio Network podcast, Business by the Numbers. Hey, Hunt.
Hey, Carm, how are you?
Hey, great, buddy. Thanks for taking time out of all your busy days to be with us. I hear an awful lot about MSOs, multi-shop operators, and the opportunity that many people have. They want to grow into their first store, and also the horror stories after store two has gotten, and the missteps that were handled in either processes, systems, people, but frankly, in the initial transaction. And that's what we're here to talk about. The episode is called Red Flags When Buying a Business. So it doesn't really matter if you're walking into store number 5, Rick. There are all kinds of important red flags that we need to be aware of. I think this is going to be a classic episode. And as Dwayne told me in an email, this could be a 10-parter.
Very true.
Hey, just with Rick.
The story has always been, so, hey, I'm Dwayne from down the road. You know me. We're with Dynamic and love to talk to you about selling your business. What, Dwayne, I want $1 million for my business. And that's what everyone says.
That's where it starts.
And that's where it starts. And years ago, guys, we were kind of rolling on the floor laughing about that because the person didn't have a clue. And I figured out that the best thing to say as a buyer is, great, I'll pay you $1 million or more. As long as I can pay for it in 5 years, let me see your financials. My what? Oh, I see. Hunt's not your accountant. Okay. When you ask for a financial, sometimes you get what? A POS system report, Dwayne?
Yeah. We had a location that the owner was selling and going through a broker at that. And I asked for the standard, give me 3 years of your financials, give me 3 years of your taxes. They kept sending me point of sale reports. And I'm like, I would ask again. And the owner didn't know what I was asking for. I expected the real estate broker to, a commercial broker. He didn't exactly know what I wanted. And I was like, I cannot buy anything off these because they're fictitious. You know, there's no way. The ones I got had a gross profit of like 78%. And by the time I got his taxes and did the math and looked into it, it was in the 30s. It was terrible. If you try to sell your business with your point of sale information, it's totally fictitious and it isn't correct.
Hunt, you've done episodes on the gap between point of sale and financial statements as far as gross margin is concerned.
Yeah, I mean, I think another thing on there that Dwayne brought up too is it's a lot different if you're dealing with a broker, right? If you're dealing with a broker versus you're dealing with an individual, it's two completely separate experiences, right? If you have some of these guys where I'm not going to fault someone. They've been doing this for 40 years. They're non-accountant. They don't care about financials. They've never sold a business before, right? They don't know if what they're sending out is really good, really bad, or even anything at all. A broker knows a lot better. And so when we get these financials and it comes from a broker and you start asking questions, really a lot of this is I'm trying to pick up on other things, right? I'm trying to get character clues because there is a huge level of trust. I've had deals where I've had clients walk away from, not because we found anything, but just we were getting some conflicting answers, right? They sent us a spreadsheet that had one sort of net profit. The tax return had a different one. The QuickBooks had a completely different one as well. None of you guys are probably going to ever get audited financials, right? Even these guys here that, you know, have more shops than most people around are not doing high-level forensic accounting because it's just not cost-effective or reasonable. And so I've told people before, you got to go with your gut. If something doesn't seem right, then it might not be. It might be right. And if it's $50,000, hey, Rick will take a flyer on you. Hey, maybe it's understated, overstated. For $5 million, no, I can't risk that. Because really, this is a leap of faith. Not that I would do this, but think about what you're looking at. You're looking at a PDF. You're looking at an Excel document. I could put absolutely anything that I want in there. Within reason, you might not be able to tell. But once you start seeing some stuff, hey, what I can see is starting to not make sense. What am I not seeing now? And you just get huge question marks on this.
You know, speaking of a red flag, here I am. I'm an owner. I've got this opportunity. It's a market I want to be in, a building I want. People that I need. I've driven by this thing 100 times in my life. I want this. Whatever. Warning.
Yeah, get pot committed on it, right? You've already mentally made the decision. I'm buying this no matter what this says. And seen a lot of people feel like that they get pot committed and just keep on going farther. Well, I've already spent this much time. I really like that location. No one else will sell to me. And usually those are the ones that end up falling through. I mean, I'd be curious of what Dwayne and Rick would say. A lot of my clients' best deals are ones where it comes back around. Hey, we're just probably not interested at that price. Keep us in mind. And magically, Rick or Dwayne get a phone call 8 months later, 12 months later. You know what? I'd got a couple other people and maybe you weren't insulting me with that offer. Now let's talk and you can have a reasonable conversation now that you've kind of bursted that bubble. I mean, this is really emotional for a lot of these people. When they come back and say, I want $2 million, most of this is not just the money. It's, hey, I've sacrificed 4 decades of my life, my entire life to build this and to get their dreams crushed of like, no offense, but it's just not worth that much to me. I got to have a return on investment. This is an investment for me. And a lot of times it takes time and sometimes it never really comes there to come down to reality of what it's really worth.
I would agree with that. I've been involved in lots of different situations. Sometimes you're dealing with a guy who's been there for 40 years and he's selling his business and it's only going to be one shot for him. And it is emotional. And, you know, they're going through everything line by line on a contract. They're scared. They're nervous because it's a one-shot opportunity. It takes time to work with people like that. Then there's people that aren't making decisions. They think they want to sell. And then I've had deals fall through a number of times where now they got to talk to the wife. Now they got to do this. Now they got to do that. And it falls apart. So there's all kinds of things that can happen. Sometimes they approach you. There's a lot of, you know, the legal side of it. I know Hunt's focused on the financial side, but on the legal side, there's a ton that you have to worry about because when you do buy their business, if you buy their business, you don't want all of a sudden a bunch of creditors and people coming out of the woodwork to say, hey, that's our equipment. You know, we sold that to that guy and there's UCCs out there and all kinds of other issues.
Guys, let me stop and ask the question about that. You're not making a stock purchase. You're making an asset purchase. If I was just buying the building and or the equipment, would I have to take any debt, any encumbered UCCs with me?
If you still have that equipment, right? If you have a, you know, Hunter alignment rack that Great American is financing.
Yeah, okay.
They're like, hey, you just bought something. And if you don't pay us, we're going to come get our alignment rack. And there's also some things too, where Dwayne and Rick have a reputation. So you get a line where it's like, what do I legally have to do versus what am I going to do to make sure that it's not, hey, welcome to the neighborhood and you're not going to honor anything of the previous owner. That's not going to be kind of a great introduction either.
And we actually research the company. We have real estate lawyer actually look and see, you know, is there any filings? What is owed? We put it in the contract that everything's paid off. It doesn't always happen though. Hey, we've had some things where we've been contacted and we'll redirect because we've always done an asset purchase. We've never bought a business. And that's our intention is to buy assets. And most of the time, it really is the assets, all the value of intent, and the LOI. You just find a way.
That's
to
a real
make
critical piece
work,
in so an arrangement, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's you're trying to get something locked down. That's the first part of the negotiations. Try to get something. Try to hit the business terms on paper so that you're both on the same page. That when it does go to the attorneys and contracts are drawn up, there's no shock. I mean, there's always going to be shock when attorneys get involved, but you know, you're trying to get everything laid out in a letter of intent that, you know, everybody's agreeable to. When I look at businesses, I always start with the quality of the real estate, the quality of the location. If there could be somebody with a fantastic business, but if it's, you know, behind the railroad tracks at a dead end, I'm not really interested, because in my strategy, I've got to rebrand it. So, you know, I'm trying to build a chain of a branded company as opposed to a single store operator coming in and just buying one location. Because, you know, you're not going to rebrand it. If there's a guy in a bad location that has a great business, you know, you don't want to rebrand it right away. Because when you do, your people are going to leave you.
What would be in the letter of intent, Rick?
Well, obviously the location, the assets, the price of equipment. Let's say he's not selling the real estate. Let's say he's leasing, he's renting the building. That's going to be subject to approval from my perspective. Because what if his rent's $2,000 a month, really, really cheap, but he's only got a year left? That doesn't work for me. I'm not interested in a deal like that. I want long-term access. If I'm going to focus on buying a business and making it mine, you know, I want long-term. That's one of the many things that can go in there.
Would you rather have the building or lease?
It depends. I like to split it 50-50. We lease, you know, we have half of our assets are leased, long-term leases, and half of them are fee properties.
Most of our, we own five and rent one. I love to own the property, but if you can get in cheap, and I know some of Rick's deals, he's done a master of a job on some of his deals, and it turns into just an income producer, which then he can just keep the ball rolling and then buy more with that. We prefer to own the real estate, but it's not necessary, but you have to have a long-term lease. And the one that we have leased, we went out 15 years, a five-year and then 2 5-year extensions with a statement that it would only be increased by market value. They couldn't jack it up after 5 years and we're doing awesome. And they say, oh no, rent doubles. So we try to protect it that way. But yeah, I'm a little leery of renting, but I'll do it.
How important is a non-compete?
Everyone's going like this.
Yeah, in theory, in practice.
Yeah.
I think it's good to have that. You want the guy to sign that. Whether it's enforceable or not, that's another situation. But I think depends upon the, you know, one of the questions is, why are you selling? How long have you been in business? I mean, there's a million questions you need to ask when you go in there and look around the location for the first time. You're going to meet him probably an ongoing operation, and he's going to say, hey, come meet me after I close. I'll show you around. That's when you're going to hit him with all kinds of questions. And then if you do get financials, and I'm not saying you will, but if you do, then you compare, well, he said his card count was this and his, you know, average row was that, and you know, his sales were this, and you know, those numbers that he told me don't match up to what's on paper. You try to vet as much as you can, get as much truth as you can, but at the end of the day, you're going to run your own numbers and you're going to see what he's asking for, and you're going to make a determination. Do I want this location? And there's a business I've purchased where, hey, the value, when I run the numbers, I think his three times might be $40,000. But I'm not going to get it at $40,000. The guy's been there for 20 years, not going to sell it for. So I want the location because I know I can do much better than he's doing.
What you're saying is bring your common sense to the dance.
You have to. It's not a science.
It's so hard to enforce, right? Because, you know, a lot of the non-competes, the only one I've ever seen successful is people egregiously, you know, voiding these non-compete agreements. But it's a lot of times where people are used to shopping and stuff like that. And I think that the big part about this is, you know, like Rick was saying, the conversation. I got an 82-year-old owner that's selling. If he doesn't want to sign a non-compete, I'm not really sure that's going to be a deal breaker for me. If it's a 32-year-old owner, something like that, someone that is a smaller shop that has, you know, the service advisor has a personal relationship, that's a completely another story. But just like when you're going to buy a used car, hey, why are you selling? You're getting, you know, character clues about what their intentions are. Hey, I'm selling this because I'm moving from Florida to Texas. I'm not really sure I'm too concerned about a non-compete because he's going to be on the other side of the country. Now, the recent thing, and I was wondering if you could go here, Carm, is, you know, they have struck down a lot of these non-competes. When we're talking about non-competes here, we're talking about an owner signing a non-compete. So, you know, not really what people have read in the news, because a couple people have reached out to say, hey, does this mean I can no longer ask for a non-compete if I'm buying a business? No, it's people with their employees trying to force them to sign non-competes.
Some of the stuff that I have heard, gentlemen, is you can't prevent someone from earning a living.
We're all in Maryland, so we have a little bit different rules here too.
Yeah. As far as non-competes, I made a mistake once of not asking for one because the guy was moving and moving far away. And all of a sudden we're 3 months into the deal and I hear, not from him. Oh yeah, he's staying now. He's not going anywhere. And I was like, oh crap. I got my banker to email me, which I forwarded to him, saying that the bank is insisting on a non-compete. And then he went and signed it. Basically, I used the bank as leverage to get it because I'm like, all right, I won't make that mistake twice. Just because their plans are to do something doesn't mean it will happen.
Hey, let's face it. Your shop management system is the single most important tool in your shop, period. NapaTrax has made selecting the right shop management system easy by offering the industry's best, most comprehensive SMS. Now, it all starts when a local representative meets with you to learn about your business and how you need to run it. After all, it's your shop, so it's your choice. And having local representation is a huge plus. Customizing tracks to your business, whether you're a one-person shop or a large multi-bay or multi-location company, a representative consults with you to help optimize your shop's workflow, efficiency, and profitability. Tracks always has the flexibility to do business how you need to do it, which means it can also grow as your business grows. And unlike the other guys, we'll be there for you after installation with the best training and support in the business. Yes, a learning management system tailored to each role in your company. Simply put, Trax was designed and built for shop owners just like you. Visit us on the web at NapaTrax, that's NapaTrax.com. Auto shop owners, as we roll into a new year, it's time to reflect. How did 2023 treat your shop? If you're shaking your head or unsure, you're not alone. If last year left you wanting more, ask yourself, what's changing this year? If the path forward seems foggy, it's time to turn on the high beams with AutoFix Auto Shop Coaching. They have the map you need to navigate the road ahead. With targeted advice on operations, finances, and team building, AutoFix guides shops from uncertainty to undeniable success. Don't let another year pass you by. If you're ready for a change but don't know where to start, AutoFix is your next right turn. Visit AutoShopCoaching.com today. Your journey to a better business begins here. Strengthen your shop's entire team with today's class. Everyone from technicians to service advisors can access impactful training on their phones in just 5 minutes a day. Opt for solo sessions or ignite friendly competition, challenging team members to climb the leaderboard for the highest score. Our effective daily training ensures measurable progress, helping you develop your team. Train smarter, not harder, with today's class and transform your shop and your people. Start seeing results today at todaysclass.com.
A great word, bank. We really don't have any talking points about financing, but it is a critical piece. And or it's not necessarily a red flag in doing the deal, but you can't walk in attempting you're going to buy something if you don't have some financing in order.
There's all kinds of financing, though. I mean, you can use banks. Our last one was owner finance, because that's what allowed them to retire. Because you pay an interest to somebody, it can be them. But I do believe, like for myself and Rick, when we approach someone, one thing that's to our advantage is they know we can do it. We have the resources. And if you're going to do something where an owner carries it, we have a lot behind us with all our other locations that they know that if this takes a while to become profitable, because sometimes it does because of the change, we can do it and we have the wherewithal. So I think it's, if you've already started adding stores, it helps when you go to talk to them because they know that it can be a factual deal and not a tire kicking event.
You made a really good point there, Dwayne, talking about using the bank as the fall guy. You know, in some aspects, and I tell people a lot too, like, well, they just tell me your accountant was the one asking this, right? But this is a relationship, right? The person, no one wants to sell something to someone that they don't like. So you don't want to kind of ruin it. Hey, you know what? I was cool with it, but my bank's saying this. Or, hey, I believe you make that much money. But you know, when this goes to underwriting, the bank's going to need to see this. Kind of, you know, showing them the parameters there. But you know, Dwayne and Rick have a unique situation where the bank knows that they can do this. They've seen them do it a number of times. They're saying, hey, we give these guys money. They know how to make money and turn into a shop. banks are getting much, much, much more selective nowadays. And especially if you're going from one location to two, they don't know if you can expand. They've never seen you do it before. So I've seen them really get stringent. Not that they're wiping out deals that, you know, cash flowed, but they're being very strict of, hey, it doesn't meet it. We're not going to touch it. And yeah, I mean, that's a huge conversation to either say, well, I got to walk from the deal, or hey, you're going to have to get creative. You want $1 million. I'm okay with it. The bank will take 700,000. You're going to have to put your money where your mouth is and hold the other 300,000 and do some owner financing here or some sort of creative solution in between.
But that is because you know you can pay that thing off in 5 years, right?
So the big thing on there is there's stuff where we look at it and we know that it was expenses and we know why people like to leverage certain expenses to get the tax benefit. And there's things that banks are allowed to add back and there's things that banks are not allowed to add back. And I'll keep that purposefully ambiguous there.
You just said these two words, the gray area, okay? And I think it's critical when you get a financial statement and along with it is the, wait a minute, there's another $90,000 in there that should be in the bottom line, but it isn't, and they can't prove it.
Yeah. Everyone says, well, hey, personal expenses, you know, discretionary, non-recurring expenses, oh, you're going to get burned. There's certain things that a bank is going to be okay with, but it generally has to be infrequent. It has to be large enough that it's just a smoking gun. Hey, look, this is in here. This is my wife's payroll. Obviously, she doesn't work here. We do this so we can max out the retirement. They're going to add that back to income. The most classical example that I get is, hey, you see these financials, it shows that I made $50,000, but I pocket probably about $100,000 in cash that no one sees. That is going to be a add back that no bank is ever going to do. And I'm never going to even use that for my sort of, you know, valuation numbers. So you're telling me that you're willing to lie to the state, the federal, the local government, but me, an unrelated party that we've never met before, you want me to just take your word for it? Again, you could go back and you could say, hey, I believe you, buddy. I know this, right? I see the wad of cash that you have here, but my bank's never going to trust that. A bank's not going to factor in unreported income to this when they go to underwriting.
So these are great points, not only for the individual who wants to buy another location, but someone that's looking to sell. Great, great points.
It's price or terms. You want a certain price. If we can agree to price, you're going to give in on some of the terms. The other thing is sometimes these guys who've been around a long time, they're very concerned about their employees. So you're right. You do build a relationship when you're buying a business. So you go in there, they want $1 million. They want whatever they want. And you go in there and you analyze their assets. You look at what the rebranding is going to cost you, the age of the equipment. You're looking at their employees, everything about the facility, how much are you going to have to invest? And then it's at the right time, you sit there and you walk through. You start with, hey, here are some things that are great about your location and about your business. And here's some of the things that I'm going to have to do if I buy this thing. Anybody's going to have to do. And so that helps you start softening them up a little bit, right? You've got to bring them to a little bit of reality. And then, of course, you know, you can maybe hold paper. That's always a good thing. But in terms of banks, when I'm looking at these locations, they'll accept our pro forma because we do have a lot of locations.
Rick, you wrote to me about what you'd like to talk about, some on-site Q&As, and I think these are just tremendous tactics in looking to make an acquisition. Let's talk about some of them.
Okay, well, I have a whole checklist that I have when I make a site visit, and I'll go through all these things. I'll ask them about usually a lot of some things I do in advance. I'll check, do they have a website? What are their Google reviews? You know, how many do they have and how many stars they have? You know, you get to the location, you ask them about their equipment, you ask them about their employees, you know, Maryland State Inspection, what certifications and so forth. What are their plans as an owner? What are they going to do? We talked about that earlier. Are you retiring? Are you moving? What's the pay structure and the benefits you offer? Are you willing to hold paper? All kinds of things like that to sort of try to figure out where they're at and, you know, where you can negotiate.
Would you send this list to the potential seller beforehand or walk in with this?
No, I have it. I glance at it, but I'm just asking questions and I'm making notes.
You're making notes. You're ultimately taking it back. You're putting some, if you will, assessments against to say, this is a 10, this is a 9. You're trying to add this up and say, where's our strengths in this potential acquisitions? Where's our weaknesses? And what those weaknesses, what's it going to cost us if we have to do a major flip?
Exactly. And again, What are the terms? What's his rent? How long is his lease? All those things. Is it a fee property? You know, if it's a fee property and he's selling everything, the bank will accept a business with the pro forma. That's not the issue. You always have to have an appraisal with a bank, and the appraisal's got to make sense. And so the guy can ask for $2 million, his property's going to appraise at $1.5 million, then you're going to have to come out of pocket. They're only going to finance so much based on the appraisal.
You just said two very important words there, pro forma. Maybe that is one word. I'm not quite sure. But Hunt, could you explain to an individual why a pro forma is necessary?
Rick's calling pro forma forecast, right? Projections. Essentially, the bank wants to know, what is this going to look like when you take it over? Really, they're looking at two things on it. They're obviously looking at the net income or the cash flow to say, hey, is this going to be able to support the loan that we're going to give you? Now, if your pro forma is very similar to the historical financials of the person that you're buying, you're not going to have a whole lot of questions. You know, the easiest thing to prove is that they've done it in the past. If you have a pro forma that's drastically different than what the current business is doing, you're going to have to go and you're going to have to paint your story about how you're going to triple the parts gross profit. And again, Rick and Dwayne coming back and saying, hey, I'm going to triple the parts gross profit. If no one's ever done that before, they're going to say, well, how could you ever do that? You've never done it before. They're able to go and say, you know what we do. You can see our other businesses. You know how this has changed. But you're essentially serving this to a silver platter to your banker. Because again, at the end of the day, this is not just numbers. If you have a banker, that banker is going to go and fight for you at committee of saying, Hunt, why are we going to give this guy $1 million for a business that's never made a profit? Well, hey, let me show you. Here's what's going down through the business. Here's what this really looks like when we get these personal or non-recurring expenses out of here. Here's what happens when we, set our proper labor rate on this. And this banker selling it to loan committee on why this is a good deal and why the bank should fund this.
Carm, I don't want to say you have two sets of financials here, but when you do a performer, we do projections for each year, but you also know your audience and the bank gets what we think we can do. And that's when we'll do what's the curb appeal? Why do we want this and what can we make it do? And that's where you just tell them like, look, we're going to institute DBIs and they've never done that. And when we did that, ARO went up 30%. And then they also look at our history and what we've been able to do. Yes, if they're already doing it at that location, that's great. But more than likely, they're not. And then they go off our history. And then we tell them, these are things we're going to put into place to make it happen. And the more of them we add, the less questions we get. They just want a curb appeal. Write down what you're going to do, and it checks all their boxes for committee.
Now, one thing that I do not think that either of you two are doing, because you've been doing this long enough, that I see the most common mistake is people making a pro forma just to appease the bank. And I'll have clients that call me up and say, hey, my bank needs a pro forma. And I say, no, you need a pro forma. Because the whole thing that you're doing is you're seeing it if you can pay the bank. If you can't pay the bank has a problem and so do you. And so you need to be doing a pro forma because that's how you measure your return on investment. Hey, great, you just paid $1 million for this. How are you going to pay this back? How many years is it going to take you? Right? You're going to be a lot happier about that return on investment that pays itself back in 3 years. If you go and do your pro forma and you're going to get paid back in 15 years, who cares if the bank is going to do it? You shouldn't do it. It's going to be a terrible investment. So being short-sighted and going through the motions of doing a business plan just because the SBA requires it or your banker asked you is foolish. Like, this is your information. And hey, if you're going to be really aggressive on some of these assumptions or some of these changes, just to try and get this loan done, then you could be really making a foolish decision. Because if the bank says, hey, we trust you, now let's see you do it, and you can't triple their ARO, then maybe that's all contingent on how you make this deal cash flow.
I agree 100%. What we do is we run six columns. First column is, what do we think they're doing? Okay. So we want to try to estimate what we think they're doing. And then we'll have a very conservative number for us, a moderate number, a little bit aggressive, what do we think we can get this to at maturity? So we may have, four, five, six columns as we run these numbers so that for us, and we obviously have to have buy-in from our operations team, right? So when I'm looking at these sites and doing these things, I'm talking to David and saying, hey, where do you think we're going to come in on this location?
And how many people have you seen burned by that, right? That they do the pro forma and they do one, which is best case scenario if everything goes right, and that's the one that makes sense. So if everything goes perfectly right, the deal is fine, but it's always easier said than done. There's always things that you don't factor in. And a lot of times that weighs into other things that you're, you know, getting as far as character clues or interviews and stuff like that, right? If you're looking at this and you're saying, this deal only works if everything goes to plan, but everything else is perfect, great location, they've been saying all the right things, we love their employees, hey, I might like that deal. Now, if this is the exact opposite, where you're like, if everything goes perfect, this will work, but the owner's kind of a little sketchy, I'm not sure I trust the financials, I'm not sure about the, you know, employees hanging around on here, you know, it all kind of goes into the, you know, bucket of weighing this of, hey, maybe this just doesn't seem like the right fit, or we can try this, but this may be a little bit riskier than we might have thought.
Yeah, and I've never seen any of them go perfect.
Never.
Yeah, you guys are in coaching groups, have a huge network amongst yourselves. What's the percentage that these first forays into their second store is huge challenges? And I mean, people maybe ultimately make it after a while, but they misstepped so many times along the way.
Now, I think we should preface this, and I think Dwayne and Rick would appreciate this. You got to put what time period you're doing. If you became a multi-shop operator during COVID, your results are a lot different than when you became a multi-shop operator in 2005, 10, 15.
Got it.
Yeah, we went to store two in 2002. We didn't do so well. It took a while. It took a while, you know, and then store three was even worse. But then slowly we got our stuff together and learned what we were doing. But we didn't have any groups back then. I didn't have my buddy Rick to call. And I have sent stuff to Rick. I got questions on real estate. I'll pick his phone up in a second because he does have so much knowledge in that area, and I value his opinion.
Thank you, Dwayne.
Sure.
Send him the check.
Yeah. I'm with Dwayne on that. We had a strategy when we first started. We had a business plan when we first started. We had service bays. We had gas stations in service bays. Our second and third location were gas stations with service. It took us years to perfect where we are a long time.
So don't expect an overnight, all of a sudden you're going to buy a place, do $2 million and make $400,000. I mean, it's just not going to happen. I mean, the expectations are there, but don't kill yourself by trying to reach them like overnight.
It can take time. As you're adding locations, it can take time. Sometimes you're going to have a location and, man, you're going to turn it around on a dime. It happens. We've had that happen too. We've had a couple of great locations right out of the gate. We got the right team in place and we hit it out of the ballpark. But a lot of times it's a slow burn.
So a good attorney, a banker.
You need a great attorney.
You got to have an accountant who appreciates what it takes for you to do business. And then you said something very interesting a few moments ago, gas stations. Oh my God, if you are looking to buy a piece of property that was a gas station, now there's a red flag.
You do environmentals on everything.
Everything.
Even if you're doing owner carry, because that has, I've had people burned over the years, because if a bank's doing, a bank is always going to do their environmental. They're going to do a phase one, possibly phase two. Those states, if a bank is not involved, you do not have to do an environmental. And I've seen a couple deals where I've said, why will they not do an environmental? Like they had in-ground lifts or in-ground tanks or whatever. And I don't think that they're doing this owner financing because they wanted to avoid taxes. They know that if this goes to a bank, that this is going to be a super fun site. And I've seen people burn by this because, you know, phase ones, phase twos, this can get extremely, extremely expensive. And yeah, I mean, it could go from, hey, this property is worth, you know, $2 million with the business and the real estate to, hey, it's essentially worthless, or even worse than that, hey, it's worthless and you need to spend a bunch of money because this is leaching into the groundwater.
An environmental is not that expensive. I look at owner carry, I follow the same pattern I would if it was a bank. Those things are in place for a reason.
Yeah.
Dwayne, one of the things that you had pointed out to me was emotions, and that you have to be really careful about it because it either sucks you in or it's a warning sign.
You know, these deals are very emotional because usually you're putting a value on their life's work. And you have to be very careful in doing that, because one is, if you insult them, they just throw you out of the shop out of hatred. And you know, you've insulted their life's work. So you don't want to do that. I always try to work my way in and try to get them, sometimes because we approach people to buy them and they don't have a price. And that's where you got to put a value on it. And I use my accountant, I use my lawyer, I use their banker, and more their friend. And I'm like, well, my banker wants this, they want that. And I just start asking questions. all right, help me explain to the bank why it's worth $1 million. Tell me. And usually they'll start bringing down the number because they realize that they had a dream. They didn't have a plan or a sound idea of what it was worth. But I try to go about it that way. And I try to respect their emotions and respect the work they've done. That way seems to get you to yes quicker. Because if you make them mad or insult them, you almost got to leave and maybe come back later. Because I think they'll sell to somebody cheaper just so you don't get it.
I got to ask a question of all three of you. And I'd like to leave Hunt to the last answer, okay? Here it is. Financial statements. What do they say? And can you build off of something that may not be perfect? What's then ultimately your accountants say about what you should really take from them? Rick?
Well, there are times when they don't really have financial statements. When they put something on a Word document or they send you an Excel spreadsheet, I don't consider that a financial statement. You're trying to forecast what you think they're doing, and then you work numbers from there. So sometimes they don't have them.
Thanks. Dwayne, did you ever get a financial statement that looked really, really bad?
I've gotten all kinds of financial statements. I'm a firm believer that myself, Rick, and a lot of other shops can actually, they can make anything work. It's just how much time and investment you want to put in there. I mean, are you willing to spend a year or are you willing to spend 10 years to get it successful? But I've looked at financials and I look at what they're doing. And then I also look at them like, all right, how would I do it? I never want to buy something for what I can do with it. I want to buy it for what they did with it. And I tell them that because they're like, oh, you have the money. You can afford this. Well, that's not a reason to give you what you're asking. But first I go off of what they did. And then I do look at it and go off, well, I think I can do it this way. And a lot of that's just off history. But yeah, I've gotten all different kinds. And then I'm like, all right, if I don't believe in the financials, let's look at their taxes. And I can't stop them from lying to the IRS, but they're less likely to do that than they are to lie to me. So I just balance them out and see, do they at least kind of look the same? And if not, I'll ask them, they will tell me about it. And then sometimes they're like, oh yeah, that bought a boat. And I'm like, well, I'm not buying boats. So we cut that one right out.
And the man who has seen all kinds of these, huh?
Yeah, I mean, like you guys said, in a perfect world, we're going to get audited financial statements that tie down to the penny to the tax return. And if you're going to wait for those deals, you're going to be passing over a bunch of very good deals. I think it seems like a foreign idea for a lot of, you know, business owners and shop owners to be running without financials. But I've had great deals that, you know, started off of, you know, financials that were written on a legal pad. It's probably shocking for people, but I would say, you know, if you looked at the entire aftermarket, less than 10 to 15% are actually running with true financials that they could take to an outside party and, you know, really even make heads or tails of. But, you know, it's one part of the equation. There's also character clues that you can look at, right? You know, not that sales is how you're ever going to evaluate a business, but you could kind of back into what the profit should be. And again, you're kind of trying to make sense of this. They're claiming that they are clearing $300,000 and you know that they did $700,000 in sales last year. There's just probably no way that they ever really did that. Now, you did know that they did about $2.3 million in sales, and hey, that's a pretty realistic number. So yeah, in a perfect world, you want to have these financials and they want to be perfect on it. But the reality is that that's not the case. Now, like I said, if you have a broker involved, if you have another professional involved, another accountant that's providing this stuff, and they're not able to give you this, then again, you know, my radar is going to go up that what I see doesn't make sense. So what am I not seeing here that could be even worse?
Carm, the other thing too, and Hunt can probably speak to this more, but you know, typically they have a price. It's goodwill and equipment. It's just one price. And then all of a sudden, you have to divide that up. How much is goodwill and how much is equipment? Obviously, the more you can allocate to equipment is better for the buyer, but the seller wants it the other way around. So for tax purposes.
It's called blue sky.
Blue sky, right? Goodwill, blue sky. So it's one of the things that you need to get ironed out. I like to get it ironed out in the letter of intent, as opposed to just coming up with a price and a letter of intent for the whole thing and then getting into it in the contract, because it's going to come up.
What kind of multiple is going on around, say a company made 10% in net operating income, or EBITDA 12% EBITDA, what kind of multiple? Is it like 2.5, 3? If it's a solid company?
I think it depends upon how many locations they have, right? The more locations, the higher the multiplier. So if it's a single store operator, like we're talking about, Yeah, I would say anywhere from 2 to 3.
And Hunt, do me a favor, explain to our audience what the multiplier really means as far as an offer.
Yeah, and so you got to be a little bit careful here, right? Because sometimes you see these crazy multiples out there and it's like, yeah, that's the multiple, but the financials were so whacked out. There's so much different things running down through there that it was probably a 3-time multiple of the recasted financials. And so when we say a 3-time multiple EBITDA, we're stripping out, you know, personal expenses, non-recurring stuff, self-dealing and all kinds of stuff like that. And usually that's a pretty good, you know, solid target. Now, what makes that multiple go higher or lower is the non-financial. I might pay a 2-time multiple because I know it's got old equipment. I know that it's not the best reputation. People haven't been there that long. I'm not sure if the guys are going to stick around. The owner's super involved on the counter. That is going to make this less valuable, even though it's making the same amount of profit as another business that has brand new equipment. Everyone's been there for 20 years and has a great reputation. So that multiple is, you know, how you add, you know, your spin on what the profit and loss is of, hey, how desirable is this business?
So as an example, if a company made $200,000 of profit EBITDA and you were willing to pay 3 times, that would be $600,000. And that included the equipment, right?
Correct.
Yeah. That's where people get into the, I need $1 million or $2 million for my business. And you go back and do the math and you make a presentation. Even one that's 3 times, because to your point, Rick, you evaluate location, you evaluate people, you evaluate market, and you're willing to pay a little higher multiple to get that because over the long haul with your pro forma, you know you can pay that back in a reasonable amount of time to pay for the money that you need to get.
One thing, especially now with labor and getting help, I made an offer on a location and they actually went and got it professionally appraised as far as the business. And we were a couple $100,000 apart, which isn't a deal breaker. But I went back and we talked about it and we'd already built a relationship now. And I talked about, all right, to make this work, you know, what you paid for the building and what I'm getting ready to pay for this building, it's a huge difference. You did it 20 years ago. Now you're benefiting there. It instantly raises my rent and what I need to do to make these numbers work. And then you're all still working in the business and I need to find more people to put in here and to build it up to actually make it successful. And I was able to negotiate it to where we were about 50-50. We came to the middle. Even though they had it professionally done, I'm like, well, once you remove you, you've just pretty much removed the value of the business. And we were able to come to terms in that way. But it took some time. But there are ways. But you got to look at, especially now, you got to have people. You got to be able to get them. And a lot of shops are having troubles with that.
When I hear the brilliance that was discussed here, because you've all been there and done it, and this is what, Hunt, you do this for a profession, also as an accredited business valuator, you can go in and help with that for your clients. I think about the networking and like you said, Dwayne, a real estate problem, I pick up the phone and I call Rick. Listen, you're about ready to buy your second or third location. Please go get some help. Get some support. Listen to this podcast and other ones that we've done on multi-shop operations. And heck, we could talk for hours on processes and systems and all that stuff that really equate to having, once you signed on the dotted line and you're in, you got to run a good business to make it all work. This was great. I loved it. We called it Red Flags When Buying a Business. I think we talked about a lot of great red flags. And it was almost like Promo the Robot says, warning, warning. Be careful.
Can I leave you with this one other thought?
Absolutely, Rick.
You may get into lengthy discussions and negotiations, and it could go over a long period of time. And you think you have a deal, and the deal doesn't work out. Always stay. Always take the high road. Always leave it on the best terms possible, because you never know. It can come back, and you may end up getting that deal done. So there's always a way. You know, you got to find out what all the issues are, whatever issues they're having. They have tax issues. They don't want a bunch of cash up front. They, you know, there's always a way to work it out. You just got to get creative.
Very good final thoughts, Rick. I appreciate that. I appreciate all that you do for us on the podcast. And of course, Hunt, the Business by the Numbers podcast on the Aftermarket Radio Network. Thank you guys so much. Brilliant stuff. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Carm.
Thanks.
Thanks, Carm.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from the premier automotive aftermarket podcast. Until next time.